Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
From Pushkin Industries, this is Deep Background, the show where we explore the stories behind the stories in the news. I'm Noah Feldman. Welcome to this week's episode. We're going to talk about abortion rights, one of the most contentious and difficult topics in American public life. Since Justice Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed to the Supreme Court, we've witnessed a radically new trend in states passing anti-abortion laws. Time was that states wanted to urge the Supreme Court to chip away at the abortion right. To do that, they passed laws that didn't outlaw abortion altogether, but rather made it harder to get access to an abortion, like the law passed a couple of years ago by Texas, ultimately struck down by the Supreme Court, which raised the restrictions and limitations on abortion clinics and doctors to try to make it harder for women to get an abortion. The theory of those laws was that the best strategy for the pro-life movement was to get the Supreme Court to say, we're not overturning Roe v. Wade, we're going to chip away at the abortion right until there's not much left of it at all. Since Kavanaugh was confirmed, the strategy is 180 degrees the other way. States like Alabama, most recently, have passed laws that just say no abortion at all, typically in the first handful of weeks of life, typically with no exceptions for rape or incest. I call these Kavanaugh laws because they're aimed at the idea that the addition of Justice Kavanaugh to the court will convince him and also Chief Justice John Roberts just to drop an opinion that overturns Roe v. Wade in one fell swoop. If that's going to happen, then we need to start thinking about strategy to deal with it. To discuss strategy, history, and how we got here, we're joined today by Catherine Colbert. Catherine is a perfect person to discuss these issues with us. Catherine actually argued in the Supreme Court in 1992, successfully, the case of Planned Parenthood v. Casey, right at the moment when people thought that Roe v. Wade was allowed to be overturned the last time. Since then, Catherine has been director of the Athena Center for Leadership Studies and professor of leadership studies at Barnard College, job from which she just recently stepped down. And she's here to discuss with us where things are going. And as you'll hear, she has lots of things to say that go clear against the conventional wisdom. I imagine that Catherine was going to talk to us about the strategies that she used to convince the Supreme Court to retain the abortion right. Nope. What she's got to say is a lot more interesting and a lot more radical. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Catherine, I just want to begin by asking about the last round in which we had to face challenges to the abortion right, the round in which you were working at the ACLU and ended up arguing the Planned Parenthood against Casey Case. What strategy were the opponents of abortion rights using then to try to go after the right to choose?
Well, the circumstances were very analogous. My case was decided by the Court of Appeals in November of 1991. And Justice Thomas had just been confirmed to the Supreme Court. It followed the very contentious Anita Hill hearings. So he too, like Kavanaugh, had been accused of sexual harassment. There was a huge outcry in the country about the conservative bent of the court, at least by those who favored the right to choose abortion. You know, there were upcoming presidential elections, in that case, the Clinton election in 1992. So circumstances were very similar, and everyone believed, including myself, that with the appointment of Justice Thomas, there were five votes on the court to overturn Roe. And our strategy was built on that assumption. We thought all along we were going to lose. In fact, in the vote following oral argument, we did lose. Mm-hmm.
But you didn't know that at the time because that was a secret vote.
We did not know that at the time. But the circumstances were very similar as today, although I have to say that I don't think the option of winning this time around is as likely as the small chance there was for us, because the new justices to the court are more conservative than Justice Kennedy. And I don't see anything in the history of Justice Roberts that would lead me to believe that he would switch his vote.
So we'll talk more about that. I mean, it is worth noting just in passing that one of those justices, Justice Kavanaugh, one of the new justices, is actually also true indirectly of Justice Gorsuch, actually worked for Kennedy. They were law clerks for Justice Kennedy, even though I agree they're seen as more conservative. But what's fascinating to me, Catherine, is to hear you say that you went to court in Planned Parenthood against Casey expecting actually to lose it. What's it like to go into argue a case in the highest court of the land with the expectation that you're going down?
Well, our strategy was built on if we lose, what's next? And in that case, it was making sure that the public, the court of public opinion, understood what was at stake. Often these things are veiled in legalese and things that most people don't understand. Frankly, they don't even understand what happens when a federal constitutional right is withdrawn, because it doesn't happen that often. So the first thing we set out to do was to make sure people understood what was at stake, and that was the loss of their liberty and the loss of safe and legal abortion. And the second thing was to set it up politically. At that time, we did control Congress and thought we could pass a bill that would protect women on a national level if the outcry was sufficient. Today, that's less possible. And I'm sure we will get into what strategies might work now. But I think what we were really doing was to try to make sure people understood what was going on.
So one of the reasons that you had to engage in that strategy is that the law that the state of Pennsylvania had passed actually didn't outright ban abortion under all circumstances, right? It required an informed consent form be signed 24 hours before the procedure that would provide information about the fetus. There was a parental consent requirement for minors. There was a requirement that women who were about to have an abortion and who were married notify their husbands. There was some play with the definition of a medical emergency. These were, in retrospect, compared to where we are today, pretty subtle attempts to constrain and limit the right to abortion. So you had to explain to people that even those things would amount to seriously chipping away at the right to choose.
Right. And let me make sure that your listeners understand. From my point of view, it makes very little difference whether it is a statutory provision like those in Pennsylvania or a total ban like that passed in Alabama. In both instances, the Supreme Court has the ability to change what lawyers call the standard of review. What kinds of deference are they going to give to the states to pass restrictive laws? Either type of law can result in the reversal of Roe. So this notion that the frontal attack by Alabama kind of laws are worse is really a misnomer. It's not true. The court can do exactly what it wants to do, that undermines the ability of women to get safe medical procedures, whatever statute is before the court. And there are currently four cases already pending that would give them that opportunity. And let me add just one more thing, which is at the time of Casey, there were three states that had totally banned abortion, actually more extreme than the Alabama law because they started from conception, not from the 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. They had no exceptions for rape and incest. So those were pending in the courts of appeals at the time we went up in Casey.
So can we dive a little deeper into that? Because I think from the standpoint of a pro-choice advocate, I totally hear what you're saying. And I understand that, you know, there might be no difference in some sense between a case that comes to the Supreme Court and gives the court the chance to overturn Roe when it's mildly limiting or has a medium weight limitation on the right to choose and an absolute ban. But from the standpoint of conservatives who don't want to have a headline that says court overturns Roe v. Wade, but also want to limit the right to abortion, mightn't there be a huge difference between those kinds of laws? And let me say what I mean by that. So imagine that you are Chief Justice John Roberts. You know, we don't know whether you would vote directly to uphold a law that banned abortion from conception or from 6 weeks. But in general, we do know that Chief Justice Roberts prefers in lots of areas of jurisprudence to chip away at precedents, to weaken old precedents, make them increasingly irrelevant, rather than to overturn them in one fell swoop. So if we extrapolate from Roberts's feelings with respect to lots of other liberal precedents, where he likes the chip away strategy, you know, death by a thousand cuts, then presumably he would prefer to gradually uphold limited restrictions on the abortion right, to weaken the abortion right over time, rather than issuing an opinion that in one go generates a headline that says court overturns Roe v. Wade. So do you disagree with that, Catherine, that from his standpoint, imagining that that's his goal, that there might be a difference between the different kinds of laws that might come before the court?
I don't, actually. I don't. The issue is always a political calculus. That is, are you going to whip up the opposition? The real problem here for conservatives is that Americans believe that abortion ought to be legal in most circumstances. Some want more restrictions, but not very many more restrictions. But only about 20-some percent think that abortion ought to be outlawed. And so when you are talking about taking away what at one point was a fundamental constitutional right, for the first time in history, it is hard to give much solace to the guy who just wants to say, let me cover up what I'm doing in order to appease my base, but at the same time not cause too much trouble. The point is, Americans disagree with the position the court's going to take, and they have, more importantly, it is a violation of fundamental principles of stare decisis, which says that when Americans rely upon precedent, when precedent is reaffirmed over and over and over again, you ought to keep that precedent, even if you disagree with it or would have decided differently the first time around.
So, Catherine, as an advocate, though, wouldn't your goal, if you were arguing one of these cases coming before the Supreme Court now, wouldn't your goal be, in a perfect world, to try to peel John Roberts and maybe even Brett Kavanaugh, if John Roberts did it, away from the position of saying we're going to overturn Roe and towards the direction of something more in the middle? Or do you think that that's not what pro-choice advocates should be trying to do strategically, that they should just be laying it right out there for the Chief Justice and saying, go ahead and do it and then watch the backlash?
Well, I think that comes down, and I'm not arguing these cases, and obviously we don't know which one is going up forward. In our case, we made the political calculation that winning that fifth vote was impossible and went forward with the idea of trying to restore the rights legislatively. Today, I still believe that Justice Roberts is not likely to support even the Casey formulation, and that for many women in this country, liberalizing or giving states greater latitude to restrict abortion, for example, allowing regulations like what was before the court in the Texas case a couple years ago, mm-hmm. effectively outlaws abortion for many, many women across the nation, makes it impossible to obtain without having to travel to a state that has greater protections. You know, everybody wants to approach this from the point of view of the justices, I want to approach it from the point of view of the women who are affected by these laws. For them, whether the court expands Casey and permits greater regulation or whether there's an outright ban, there's very little difference. And if you're young and if you're poor and if you have no access to transportation to different states or if you're living in an abusive relationship, none of that really matters much. That means we need to start thinking about other ways to protect women's liberties.
I hear you loud and clear. I'm glad you brought up the case from a couple of years ago, Whole Women's Health against Hellerstedt, which, just to remind listeners, came out of Texas and it involved a state law that was designed effectively to make it much, much harder for abortion providers actually to function in the state. The idea was to impose restrictions and requirements on clinics and physicians who performed abortions that would be effectively the same as putting them out of business in order to make it much harder for abortion to be obtained, while simultaneously winning over the middle of the court. And in that instance, Justice Kennedy, who was still on the court at that time, wasn't buying it. And he said that those laws violated the standard that he set up in Planned Parenthood against Casey, the undue burden standard. He was willing to join an opinion that said that they impose an undue burden on women. Chief Justice Roberts, on the other hand, was in the dissent, and he thought, without saying explicitly that he thought that Casey should be overturned, that Casey could be applied to allow these restrictions. That's where I, and I think others, are getting the idea that Roberts's preferred strategy on the other side would be a slow chipping away at the abortion right rather than a one fell swoop overturning. But I hear you saying, Catherine, that you're not that interested in strategizing for winning in the Supreme Court. Your view is abortion rights are going to lose in the Supreme Court and we have to think about what to do after that happens. Am I getting that clear? I want to make sure I get it clear.
That's clear. That is, whether you're chipping away or you're totally overruling Roe, the effect for women's access to abortion, and let me just say also contraception, because that's next down the line, is going to be seriously in jeopardy. And the only thing in my mind that matters is how are women actually affected who need valid and safe medical procedures? And that's what we're talking about, and that's what we need to focus on.
So I want to turn to that in just a second, but I just want to say first, to be completely honest, my mind is kind of blown by your answer, because here you argued the case in which the Supreme Court, you know, famously took a middle ground. They basically said, you know, we're not that crazy about Roe v. Wade, but it's been in place at the time for roughly 20 years. We're going to uphold it on the principle of stare decisis, the idea that we don't want to overturn a well-established precedent. And Justice Kennedy famously said that liberty finds no refuge in a jurisprudence of doubt, by which is a little hard to know what he meant by that, but it sounds like what he means is we can't be constantly taking away rights that have traditionally been granted. So I imagined, wrongly, that your view would be that it would be good to win some middle ground holding pattern, and maybe that would buy us, you know, enough time for the public to be able to block laws like those are being passed in Alabama and elsewhere. But I'm hearing the opposite from you, and I'm also hearing the opposite of how you were thinking when you went into Casey, and that's great. I'm learning a huge amount from this conversation. So thank you. Tell me what you think advocates for abortion rights then should be doing. What strategy would you like to see followed, both in the court in cases where, in your view, pro-choice people are going to lose, and also more broadly in the society?
So first in the court, clearly whatever cases are headed there, it sure would be nice to delay them as long as possible. Again, on the theory, if you're going to lose, let's lose later. But second, I think in the courts, we want to look to state courts, particularly state Supreme Courts, to establish independent state constitutional rights to abortion and reproductive freedom. A number of states have done that in the context of Medicaid funding for abortion. For example, the Kansas Supreme Court just a couple of weeks ago issued an opinion establishing an independent right. And the value of that is it permits state courts to then strike down as unconstitutional under the standards that are independent to the states, any restrictive laws that are passed at the state level.
So I hear you, and it makes perfect sense. Isn't that hopeless, though, in the very states that are passing the most restrictive anti-abortion laws, the Alabamas, the Georgias, the Iowas? I mean, isn't it precisely those states where state Supreme Courts, and in some cases, I should add, those state Supreme Courts are elected. The Alabama state Supreme Court is actually elected. I mean, talk about strategies that seem unlikely to work. Isn't it the case that almost all states where a legislative majority would enact a ban on abortion are also the same states where the state Supreme Court would say it's constitutional to do so?
Yeah, some, but not all. So, for example, Pennsylvania has a democratically controlled state Supreme Court. I don't know where they're going to come down on abortion, but their legislature is very red. And they just passed a ban on abortions if you needed it in cases of Down syndrome. So the answer is yes and no. States vary. Alaska, for example, very libertarian state. Their Supreme Court reflects that libertarian notion. Look, and I'm talking about a 10-year strategy here. We're talking about how do you preserve rights in the short term and the long term. And obviously, state constitutions are a longer term strategy. I've always believed you need to establish a parallel and independent right at the state level.
So it might work in purple states, in other words, where the legislature is red, but the court is bluish.
Well, and also in states where the Supreme Court is elected and the majority of the citizens believe in the right to choose, just because the legislature is red doesn't mean the citizenry is. And it's a lot easier to elect two or three or four justices to a Supreme Court than an entire legislature. So, you know, there's plenty of opportunities there.
So go on then to talk about the other strategies that you were alluding to earlier.
So on the legislative level, obviously the preferred route is to have a federal constitutional right or a federal legislative right so that women have the same rights in every state. You know, your ability to make reproductive health decisions shouldn't depend on where you live. To do that, you would need to take back control of the Senate with a pro-choice majority and pro-choice leadership. So that would probably mean turning it blue. And you would need a pro-choice president who could sign it into law. Again, a possibility in 2020, less likely than it has been in some years, but certainly a possibility in 2020. But the other route, which I am firmly of the view that we need to pursue, is that state legislatures are often controlled by very few people. A few flips will make a difference in terms of control. A pro-choice governor who's willing to veto a bad bill is really key. So we need to look politically at the states. I would start with electing pro-choice governors. My preference is women governors who understand these issues, but certainly any governor who's pro-choice is phenomenal. And then to take control of at least one chamber of a state legislature in order to block bad laws. You know, in the days after Webster was decided and before Casey, I was the ACLU's person who went out to the states and developed the expertise on killing bad bills. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of ways you can do that.
Yep.
I mean, I was in 44 states in those years, in a two-year period, where there were over 800 restrictions introduced. And there's lots and lots of ways to kill bad bills, but the easiest and best is to either have leadership of one chamber or a governor who can veto. And frankly, we ought to be focusing on it strategically, geographically, because now most blue states are on the coasts, and we got to give women in the middle of the country some options closer to home.
May I try to dig a little deeper on your proposal for a federal law, obviously requiring a pro-choice majority in both houses and a pro-choice president that would protect abortion rights for women? I have sort of two questions about that. The first is, do you think that the Democrats should have passed such a law during those handful of brief moments over the last 50 years where they had that? There was a brief moment in the Clinton administration where that existed and another brief moment in the Obama administration where that existed. Did the Democrats miss an opportunity thinking, well, the Constitution now protects abortion rights, so we don't need a federal law? Should they have tried to pass a law then?
No, because it would have undercut the constitutional right, which we believed to exist.
Huh. So it's not a story of missed opportunity. So let me ask a follow-up question then. Imagine that Congress did pass such a law, and I know I don't want to get too into the constitutional law weeds, since you argue constitutional cases, and I teach constitutional law for a living, and it would be easy for us to go too into the weeds. But I'm wondering, Wouldn't such a bill be vulnerable to the idea that the Supreme Court could strike it down, a conservative court could strike it down by saying it was an overreach and that the federal government didn't have the capacity to block the states from passing laws that restrict women's right to abortion?
Even a conservative court, I think, would be going very far to do that. I just don't see them doing that.
I mean, they'd be going pretty far to strike down Roe v. Wade, right? I mean, our scenario is precisely a scenario where they've gone all the way to, as you said, eliminating a constitutional right. It's one of the first times the court would ever have done that.
Right. But at the same time, that is their sweet spot. That is, the role of the Supreme Court is to interpret the federal constitution. Well, I don't see any constitutional basis for saying that a federal statute protective of women's rights was undermining the ability of states to control in this area. That the whole nature of federalism is it allows federal statutory protection. I just don't see, like, a Ninth Amendment.
Well, what I had in mind was the Violence Against Women Act, which, you know, passed by actually a bipartisan majority and signed into law, which included, among other things, provisions allowing suits by women who'd been subject to gender-motivated violence. And the Supreme Court struck that law down, that part of the law down, on the ground that Congress had overreached itself. So that was the sort of thing I had in mind.
But that was a Commerce Clause argument. That is, there was no authority to pass the federal law. I think that there's multiple locus of authority to pass a federal statute, both the 14th Amendment, Section 9, the Commerce Clause. I mean, women are going from state to state. Doctors are going from state mm-hmm. to state. Commerce is moving from state. I just don't see it being comparable.
And then the other question that I had about that was, you know, one of the things that pro-life advocates have sometimes sought, it's kind of their, it goes even beyond overturning Roe v. Wade. It's on their, you know, it's on their bucket list, would be for the Supreme Court actually to say that under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which says the government can't deprive persons of life, liberty, or property, that fetuses are persons. And if the court were to say that a fetus was a person, then it would be impossible for states, I mean, that would take us much further. That would mean not only that we'd have the opportunity for some states to have laws prohibiting abortion and other states to permit it, that would actually effectively outlaw abortion at the national level.
Yeah, I just don't see even this court going that far for lots of very practical reasons. Because once you say a fetus is a person, does that mean they get a Social Security card? Does that mean they, you know, have rights in car accidents and murder charges and all? I mean, there's just so many implications of creating personhood mm-hmm. and very little support for it. Even, you know, even in Roe, the court was very clear that wasn't a place they were going. I haven't seen any court even at the state level go that far or any district court go that far. I just don't see it happening.
Although that might be a strategic concern if there was a movement to pass federal legislation, that there might be some worry that it would be an invitation to the court to do that.
Right. And in fact, they have done that in past years. That, for example, there was a fetal personhood amendment to the Constitution introduced in Congress repeatedly for probably 20 years.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem to go anywhere.
So going back to the state legislatures, which is where you see the battle building, it sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that what you're picturing is kind of ongoing long-range guerrilla warfare at the state level between pro-choice and pro-life advocates, with the pro-life advocates constantly trying to get legislatures to pass laws and pro-choice advocates going out to those states, just as you did to 44 states, you said, you know, using various political techniques to try to kill bad bills and to try to elect more liberal representatives or governors. And in that environment, it seems as though there is the real risk that in a bunch of states, especially as you point out, states in the middle of the country, there will be women who can't afford to travel to other states to have an abortion who are really going to face substantial constraints on their right to choose. Is that your, you know, all things being equal, prediction of where we're headed? I mean, that sounds like what you're saying, and I want to be clear to if that is what you're saying.
Yeah, unfortunately. Look, elections really matter. I did a speech for medical students for choice 2 weeks before the 2016 election. And with the election of Hillary Clinton, we would have been absolutely assured that there was the next justice of the Supreme Court would have been pro-choice, and none of this would have mattered. But yes, elections matter, and they're going to matter for women in a whole host of ways. Abortion's kind of the tip of the spear. But don't think that the 25 men in Alabama who passed this bill aren't coming after women in a whole variety of ways, whether it be equal pay or whether it be sexual harassment or whether it be all kinds of protections that we have understood to be constitutionally protected at the federal level. So in my view, yes, it is trench warfare, but pro-choice Americans need to understand that if they're going to preserve their liberties, we got to work hard at it. And we've got to do more than protest in the street. We've got to, you know, go out and canvass and send postcards and make phone calls and do all of the hard work that most people don't love to do, but that the anti-choice movement has been very good at.
May I ask you about following up on that idea that the pro-lifers have been very successful in what they do? What sounds like it might be, maybe I'm wrong, but a kind of tension between two different things that I hear you saying. So on the one hand, I hear you saying that this is a long-term battle. It's trench warfare or guerrilla warfare, and some kind of long-run, painful warfare, in which, in your read right now, the pro-choice side is losing, and in your prediction, is about to lose really the crown jewel of not only abortion rights, but arguably of women's rights in the United States, namely the holding of Roe v. Wade. On the other hand, you pointed out earlier that only maybe a quarter of Americans actually will tell pollsters that they think there shouldn't be an abortion right under any circumstances. So if those things are both true, why are they both true? Why is it, if it's a relatively small number of Americans who support the significant restriction of abortion rights, that the pro-choice forces are losing as badly as you've described them as losing?
Well, for two reasons. It's called political power. It's called Senator McConnell, who blocked President Obama's appointment to the court, and his push for anti-choice judges and taking over the crown jewel, which was the Supreme Court. And that's power. The Republicans have never been afraid to exercise power, and Democrats have been more reluctant to get into that brawl. But the other thing, and I think this is important for people to understand, is that legislatures don't often or don't always reflect the views of their constituents unless they're forced to do so. And it is instructive to me to see Republicans now get nervous when they understand that Roe is in jeopardy, that, oh, all of a sudden they're going to have to be accountable for their vote, because up until now they've kind of coasted without having to either take a position or to take a position that wasn't really thought seriously as being significant. Let me just say one other thing. In the days after Casey was handed down, the first maybe 5 years, there was very little activity at the state level restricting abortion. There was some. There was passage of laws similar to the Pennsylvania law. But you didn't see these huge efforts that you're seeing now. And the change started to happen in 2010, following the census, when there was reapportionment, redistricting, a lot of gerrymandering, a lot of restriction on voting rights, you began to see more and more state legislatures, gubernatorial seats taken over by the Republicans, and therefore an uptick in the anti-choice activity. To me, what's really critical is that we understand that voting rights is now a women's issue. That if we're going to protect women's rights, we need to have fair districts. We need to have fair voting rules. We need to count every vote. Until those things are fixed, minorities are able to exert more power and control than is particularly fair.
I really want to emphasize just how profound the thing you just said was, at least to me. You said legislatures do not necessarily reflect the views of their constituents. I mean, I can't think of really a more devastating critique of democracy itself. You know, I mean, the whole theory of democracy is supposed to be that we elect representatives and that they represent the views that we hold. And, you know, if they're not representing the views that we hold, then democracy is failing in some pretty fundamental sense. I mean, do you share that the pessimism that sounds to me is implicit in that observation?
You know, I actually feel very optimistic that women are getting it. Let me give you an example. Vote Run Lead, an organization in New York, was training women to run for political office. Last week, they had 1,400 women in 20 states coming out to learn how to run for political office. That says to me, there's a tsunami going on among women who are saying, this ain't fair. We got to get involved. We've got to fix it. And that's a really good sign. But that dichotomy between who has power and who could earn power at some later date is kind of where we're at right now. And all I can do is be optimistic that we will work really hard to make a difference here.
So your optimism, if I am summing it up correctly, is it begins with the pessimism that you think Roe v. Wade is done for, but then you're optimistically expecting a major mobilization of women across the country to run for office and win and change laws across the country so that in the end, the final outcome, though of course the loss of Roe v. Wade would be a terrible thing for women's rights, might actually be greater for the greater good because it will mobilize so many people to go out and vote. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I'm hoping at least we could get back to where we were when we had federal constitutional protection. And that may be a long time. You know, if you don't have some optimism that you can make a difference, it's hardly worth joining the fight. So, you know, I try to remain as optimistic as possible.
Well, it's inspiring to hear you maintaining optimism even through a veil of what strikes me as extremely powerful pessimism. It's a you have a story of the worst of times maybe leading to the best of times. So I'm very grateful to you for sharing that vision with us. It's fascinating. And I can't say it's purely inspiring because the worst of times part is pretty depressing, but at least there's a silver lining that you're describing in the looming storm. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Noah. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Deep Background is brought to you by Pushkin Industries. Our producer is Lydia Jean Cott, with engineering by Jason Gambrell and Jason Rostkowski. Our showrunner is Sophie McKibben. Our theme music is composed by Luis Guerra. Special thanks to the Pushkin Brass, Malcolm Gladwell, Jacob Weisberg, and Mia Lobel. I'm Noah Feldman. You can follow me on Twitter at Noah R. Feldman. This is Deep Background.
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry, and me, I'll be there too. Enter now at tmobile.com/unconventionalawards. See you there.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
There are choices that can change your life.
Like the choice to start routine colorectal cancer screening at age 45.
It's one of the most common cancers for women and men. And it doesn't always have symptoms.
But there's good news. Routine screening can catch colorectal cancer early and even prevent it.
And there's even better news. You have screening options.
Make the choice to put your health first. Talk to your doctor about your screening options or visit cdc.gov/screenforlife for more information.